Hello, this is Daniel Jalkin.
And this is Manton Reese.
And this is Core Intuition. It hardly has any features. This week's show is sponsored by CocoConf and SmartGo.
So, Daniel, about a month ago, I was at the TVOS Tech Talk in Austin, and we talked briefly about it, but we kind of wanted to wait until you had also gone to your version of it, which I assume is real similar to mine, but on the other side of the country. And so you just got back from New York City, right?
Yes, indeed. Yep, went down to New York. It's about a four-hour bus ride, if you're lucky. And the location in New York was great because it was right by Grand Central Terminal. So folks who were coming in from the suburbs and even further, if they were taking transit, it was like a good location. So kudos to Apple choosing a great location in New York City for this event. It was, it's interesting what you said about assuming that it's probably the same event. I think that's largely true, except, and I think this is kind of a newer thing that they're doing, they have like parallel teams running these things right now.
Oh, really?
It first kind of came to my mind when I was in New York the night before the Tech Talk, and then I'm on Twitter and I see somebody celebrating the London Tech Talk, which is happening that very day.
Right.
The day before the New York one. And I'm like, whoa, those folks are going to like hop in a plane and like, I don't know, sleep overnight and get out and come and do this Tech Talk. And of course, that's not the case. What it was is there's a completely parallel team conducting the tour in one city while another team might be conducting it. I don't know if there's ever two on the same exact day. I think maybe not, but
this is surprising because there's really not that many stops.
And I know.
So I can see maybe a kind of like a team on the ground that's like getting everything set at the hotel, but it seems like the speakers, seems like they'd be the same because they could arrive maybe more at the last minute. That surprises me. There's not that many of these. There's only like a few in the United States and a handful around the rest of the world.
Yeah, I'm looking at the page now. Actually, there's only a total of 11. And yeah, you're right. And the dates in many cases are not so spread out that it would seem like it would be hard to have one team. It does seem weird. It seems kind of like a redundant waste of effort to have two teams trained to do these talks.
Right.
But maybe, I don't know, maybe they didn't do it in parallel the whole time. Like, okay, so for example, Toronto, December 7th, Los Angeles, December 10th. That would have been easy enough for that team to, you know, cruise over there. But then it makes me wonder, though, if they didn't just have, like, wherever there's a couple that are, like, in close succession, maybe they were two different teams. So, for example, Austin, the one you went to, was on December 14th. And then they had Seattle on December 16th. Now, I don't know whether you had the same team as Seattle or not.
Yeah, no, it's interesting.
But for example, John Galenzi wasn't at ours. Was he at yours?
I don't think so. I didn't see him.
Yeah.
Although I have to admit, I didn't really take very good advantage of the labs. So I may have missed him and a bunch of other people.
Ours was sort of emceed by Alan Schaefer, you know, games technology evangelist from Apple. Mm-hmm. And was he the same guy running yours?
Think
do you remember?
So.
You weren't really there, were you? Manton wasn't really there.
I promise I was paying attention at the time.
Yeah. So anyway, I don't know. I had the sense in past years that that the Tech Talks were mostly run by a solitary crew. I think I had the sense in the past that maybe like the team that went to Japan was different for some reason. I don't know. Anyway, it was fun. It was good. It was, I don't know if you had the same vibe at your version of the Tech Talk, but there was sort of the challenge to Apple and the challenge to the Apple TV as a platform, I think, is that there was a prevailing mood in the Tech Talk among the attendees of, I don't really know what to do for this thing.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone's kind of like, well, are you working on anything? Not yet.
Yeah.
Which is not the level of excitement that I would want if I were in Apple's shoes trying to pump this as a new exciting platform.
Definitely. It seemed like you've got like a few game developers who were kind of excited from the very beginning and they're either shipping apps or about to ship apps. And then you have the rest of us.
Yeah.
We were interested. We're excited. We use it as users, I guess. You know, I use it all the time. but we're not exactly sure what to build for it. I felt like the sessions did a pretty good job catering to both of those groups. Like, there were certainly some things that were felt very specific to games and control, and then there was some that were more how to think about the user interface and designing your app. It could be anything.
Right. And then there was like the whole session about TVML, which is like, hey, some of you out there, I'm sure, are just here to figure out how to package your streaming content for the TV. This is for you.
And that's a good question, because I wonder, I mean, I just said there were two kinds of people. I really wonder if that's true, if there were a lot of like media company type people that I don't know any of those, but TVML, I thought was going to be more interesting than it ends up being. Like, when I first looked at all of this, the fact that TVML was like a supported thing that they were telling developers they could use, and that you could kind of mix some of this a little bit. I thought I might even use something for, like, if I had my Mac app Clipstart on, you know, the Mac, and I wanted to stream videos or something to the TV. I thought maybe I could even use TVML to just quickly bootstrap the app, get it up and looking good, feeling good on the platform. But when I kind of dove into it, it seemed not like a good fit. Like, if you know iOS, if you've been doing Objective-C, Swift, whatever already, feels like just building a native app is probably the way to go.
Yeah, and I have to admit I wasn't paying the closest attention during that session, because I thought I was predisposed to think it wasn't for me. But it was, you know, I think what I hope for going to these talks is, you know, there's a few different things. One of them is just to, like, meet and talk to other people, meet and talk to people at Apple, hopefully get inspired by something, to have a new way of looking at development. And then also just, like, you know, sit through the talks, even if you don't think you're going to be interested, just to hope to come away with some new understanding, however so slight, about it. And with TVML, I think that a key thing I didn't understand is that you can mix and match. Like, you can supplement with native code.
Right.
And that was new to me. Or I kind of assumed that TVML would be just a pure codeless approach. And it probably was for the previous iterations of the Apple TV, right? Like,
I'd expect so.
Yeah, probably they weren't, because I don't think they had tackled the notion of an SDK per se, you know, or a framework rather for native code before. But I could see if it's like, it's sort of almost just like a template for doing for a very common type of app for the Apple TV. And then if you just extend that with native code where you see fit, in that sense, it's almost just like using a pre-made storyboard or something for a specific kind of app.
Yeah. When I was playing with it, I didn't feel at home. I thought that I would kind of jump into it and it would be even easier to get started with TVML than it is. I felt like it was kind of forced, and that it would be a kind of almost a learning curve just to use TVML that would undo all the experience I have building collection views and other things that can very quickly do a lot of things that TVML can do.
Yeah.
So yeah, I went in hopeful, which I think is kind of the opposite. A lot of people, like you said, they kind of tuned out TVML. A lot of developers and people in our community, they tuned it out because they just assumed it wouldn't be as good. I went in thinking it might be a great head start, and kind of came back around to what other people already think, which is probably not a great fit if you're already building native apps.
Yeah.
But what did you think overall? I mean, you said you came away kind of inspired. I mean, I felt like it was great. They do a great job. I definitely learned some new things, even though I didn't come back and immediately start coding on anything. I certainly learned more about the platform and the thinking that Apple's put behind this. And so hopefully that'll pay off. I think it's been helpful.
Yeah, and I didn't come away with an inspiration per se. There were a few like fleeting ideas I had while I was, you know, sitting there looking at some of the examples of what they offer. You know, they had the announcement. I guess it was probably common knowledge if you were paying attention, but the announcement in the context of the show that Apple TV now supports MapKit. And I thought that was kind of a cool, I don't know, made some gears turn anyway.
Yeah. Now I just need WebKit and we'll be good to go.
Yeah, right. But they had, you know, throughout the day, I sort of was trying to kind of like pick my own brain, I guess, about what are these different people doing? What what can you do with the Apple TV? So I wrote a post trying to synthesize that stuff on bit splitting, and it came down to four categories. I'm sure there are more, but the four categories that got me thinking, like, this will wipe out a bunch of different types of apps. And there were passive entertainment, which is kind of like just classic streaming broadcasting, games, which is the other real obvious one. And then I called another category interactive entertainment, just kind of nodding to the fact that, well, this is like still something you sit on the couch and sort of maybe just interact with the content that's coming out of your TV somehow. Still sort of a very specialized TV related thing. And then I think the category that came to mind that I think is the most potentially inspiring to me, and maybe something that would help other people who don't see themselves as, you know, media providers or game makers, is this idea of the TV as a interactive sort of canvas for families or even individuals to work with. And the metaphor I came up with is like, you have a big piece of paper on a table and you're all gathered around it, and like a box of crayons or something, right? Like, that there's a lot of activities that have happened in throughout history with basically a bunch of people around a canvas of some kind figuring out something to do with it. And that's a real broad way to look at the TV, but that's how I'm starting to think. Like, that's where some of the interesting things are going to come out, I think, where it's not like you're not relying on some media company's archive of, you know, intellectual property, and you're not relying on you know, the cleverness of a game invention per se, but you're just giving people these tools to interact with each other through the screen. And I don't know, there's something interesting there, I think, but yeah. I don't know what it is, of course.
Yeah, I haven't seen a lot of apps, or I haven't really seen any apps that I would say fall into that fourth category yet, but I love the idea. I feel like a lot of things do hit that third, interactive entertainment. Like, when I think of one of the apps that we use a lot on the Apple TV is the Airbnb app, because it does such a great job of, you know, everyone's gathered around and you're flipping through, you know, full screen photos of places if you're planning a trip. And we were just doing this a couple days ago for a potential summer trip, and just flipping through, and it hardly has any features. It really has no features, like, compared to the Airbnb website or the iPhone app. But just being able to flip through and people say, oh yeah, stop on that one, you know, flip up on that one, and then favorite something. That's all it can do. That's just really a lot of those category of apps, they're really just native websites, you know, native interfaces for websites. But something about anything that takes advantage of the screen, I think I've said this yeah. before, but it's a really nice fit for the TV, having full screen photos or whatever you've got. You mentioned Wikipedia articles, which I think could be really great too. I haven't seen an app like that yet. Have you seen anything?
No, I haven't been paying close attention though, so it might be there. I think that that's, I do think though that that's one category where it's accessible to folks like us, because there are, you know, in that category, I think the thing to keep in mind is, what are the sort of vast open information repositories that are available to everybody and that you can capitalize on by packaging it in a convenient, entertaining, accessible way on the TV. Mm-hmm. And I think that is definitely something, like, you know, I could see myself, you know, there's different types of entertainment. Some people want to sit down and they want to, like, blow up zombies. I am typically more in the mood for sitting down and, like, lazily enriching my knowledge of something, right? So, like, people like that, you want to sit down at the TV and say, okay, I don't have a lot of energy, but what if I just click my way through learning a little bit about, I don't know, Roman mythology or whatever, you know? And if there's apps that can take advantage of data that's out there and package it nicely that way, I think that's another success category for the Apple TV.
Makes sense to me, especially since you don't have the web. And, you know, I joked about it a minute ago, but I really think it's a serious problem that the web isn't on the Apple TV. But it's also an opportunity for developers to build native interfaces, because it's just not there. Yeah.
Yeah.
I agree with you. That seems like a nice thing that the folks, you know, the rest of us that aren't interested in games could tackle. I, I still don't think it's maybe compelling enough for me to actually work on something, but
yeah,
you know, who knows? I also think you could do things with like, you know, the next version of tvOS. I think if they provided almost more the ability to run, you know, you have iPad multitasking where you can pull apps like slide over and split view. If you could have something more like that on the Apple TV, I think that would also open up another class of these kind of apps where you're watching something, but you can slide over, you know, mm-hmm. Wikipedia entry or something else. And they have some of this kind of stuff baked into tvOS from Apple's sources, you know, like figuring out something about the movie you're watching. But as far as I know, that's not open to third parties. If they could open that up in a kind of a slide over multitasking kind of way, I think that could be really powerful. And because I can think of some apps that fall into this category of interactive entertainment, even things like a Twitter app, for example, but they just don't really work full screen. Like you really don't want to be just looking at that the whole time. But if you're watching a movie and then you could quickly slide over your timeline, like that makes a lot of sense to me.
Well, we'll see where things go. Okay, we're happy to have back as sponsors this week our friends at CocoConf. And of course, CocoConf is a technical conference series for software craftsmen developing for Apple platforms. They provide some of the best authors, trainers, and speakers to the most passionate, engaged developers in a region. Together, they make magic. This year, CocoConf will be in Chicago in March, Austin in April, Seattle in May, Washington, D.C. in September, and San Jose in November. CocoConf will also be returning to Yosemite this coming March 14th through 17th. Speakers at Yosemite this year include Andy Anatko, Jim Dalrymple, Gene McDonald, Jonathan Mann, Jesse Char, Michael Lopp, and Nevin and Krista Morgan. For more information and to register, visit CocoConf.com. Listeners can use the code CoreInt to save 20% on tickets for all 2016 CocoConf events, including Yosemite. Thanks to CocoConf for sponsoring the show.
Yeah, it's great to have them back sponsoring the show. Also great to welcome them back to Austin, Texas this year. And Yosemite in particular, I love that they're doing this again. You know, when they first announced this, it seemed like such a great idea to have a talk in the middle of a national park that's, you know, part of the name for macOS 10. And then I was thinking, you know, where are they going to have it next year? But Apple kind of solved that problem for them by picking the name of something in the same park. So it's a Yosemite again. And like you said, there's a great speaker lineup. And just imagine yourself there if you didn't make it last year and being surrounded by something beautiful and inspiring. And, you know, as part of that, they have like a guided hike with James Duncan Davidson is leading that, like a photo walk. He's been a photographer for TED Talks and he's a longtime member of the Mac and iOS community. And, you know, just imagine taking a break from some of the sessions and just going out and, you know, taking some photos, walking around. I think this would be a really inspiring conference. So I hope listeners can check it out. And of course, the regular CocoConf has a different feel to it, but it's probably in a city, hopefully kind of near you. So check that out as well. So again, the coupon code is CoreInt to save 20% off any of these. Check it out at CocoConf.com.
All right, this week we have some feedback from a conversation we touched on a little bit previously about Twitter's rumored expansion to allow up to 10,000 characters in some tweets, I guess as a text attachment probably. Friend of the show, Charles Parnot, writes us to say he's worried that with 10,000 words, support via Twitter will become an alternative to public forums, etc. And he doesn't know if he's too happy about the idea because that's just one more support channel. And he says it is mixed up with other non-support related stuff on Twitter, like it's like using an email client for support and makes it harder to integrate with other tools like GitHub or bug trackers. And this, Manton, sort of gets at an ancient question and even I would say rift in the development community, whether you should support users in one consolidated location or whether you should embrace the notion that users should be entitled to support in, you know, in the venues that make them most comfortable. And I remember this is something actually that Brent Simmons got to years ago. I think it was Brent. He was defending the idea of, you know, supporting customers through mail or on forums or on Twitter or wherever, because, you know, that's a very user-centric attitude to take. And Obviously, you know, if you have multiple support venues, users, I think, will be drawn to the one among them that they're most comfortable with. So should Twitter, first of all, I mean, there's two questions here. Should Twitter be a support venue? And then secondarily, would expanding the text limit to 10,000 words make it sort of an even more cumbersome support venue than it already is?
Yeah, and it kind of is good and bad. It's kind of an improvement and a step back for support on Twitter, because one of the problems with Twitter support is that, of course, you can't fit a lot in 140 characters. And so it's easy to like mangle a support question or an answer, and then you get into tweet storms trying to reply multiple times. I mean, it's really a bad way to support someone. But so in a way, you'd think, well, expanding to 10,000 characters solves that. But then the other problem is it's an extra effort to get to those 10,000 characters. Like, I think right now I use Zendesk for support, and email and tweets go into it. And of course, I get hardly any tweet support requests, but they all go into it as tickets. But if someone puts everything in the 10,000 characters, I assume that won't go in to Zendesk. It would be an extra click out. And I mean, it might be fine, but it's just something to think about as we have tools that integrate with this stuff. We have no idea if that text will be easily accessible.
Yeah. Well, I think, I framed it as being two questions. One, whether Twitter is good for support or not. And I think that's sort of like, doesn't matter what you think, because customers, if you have a Twitter account, customers will use it to some extent for support. And I remember in the early days of Twitter, people coming to terms with this, myself included. I think I remember like Panic making a point of kind of adopting the same attitude I had, which was if people tweeted at my company account, I would just sort of politely respond like, thanks for getting in touch. It's really better to handle support through email. Will you please email me?
Right.
And that sort of faded away over the years as it became increasingly apparent that, I mean, Twitter is, indisputably, it's like in its own way, it's like a primary support venue for companies all over the world now. And it's like kind of weird that that's happened that way. But I think it's almost like, I think if you don't want to offer any kind of support through Twitter today, you should just not have a Twitter account, because that's what everybody expects.
Right. If you have a Twitter account, you're basically saying it's okay to tweet at me, which I think is fine. I mean, the thing about Twitter, you know, people like to complain on the internet, and Twitter amplifies that, I think, because of the short nature of it. And just because, I mean, just look at Twitter. I mean, maybe not your time, but just look at the general sense of Twitter, and people are complaining about everything. And so that actually ties kind of into support and wanting to get answers quickly from a company. Yeah. I think it's fine. I mean, when I shut down my main Twitter account at Manton, I didn't shut down at Riverfold. And in fact, recently I haven't really tweeted anything from it in a while, but I had the idea that I would start embracing it as a support channel and a way to promote things about my company. And I think that's fine.
Yeah.
It's more work, right? To have multiple things you have to keep track of. And that's why I mentioned trying to have tools that make that easier. But this has always been a problem. Like, for a while, having forums on your company website was a great way to do support. I tried it for a little while and it was overrun with spam, and I just had to eventually phase it out. I think you still have forums. In fact, I know you do, because I found an answer there recently about Mars Edit. And that seems to be working pretty well for you. But I think it takes a certain kind of company that has a kind of a community that fits well with forums. But again, it's just one other thing to check, and you're only one person, right?
Yeah, and it's actually, I have mixed feelings about the forums. I definitely started the forums for Red Sweater embracing that idea from Brent that customers should be supported wherever they want to be supported. And the fact is, some people are more comfortable with a venue that allows them to sort of search existing questions, corroborate their, you know, answers with the answers from others, you know, to have the opportunity to have their questions answered or refined by other members of the community. That's more comfortable to some people than email. I do prefer mostly email. And I don't, I guess, you know, I've frequently wondered, should I just shut down the forums? There's some real downsides to them, which are sort of similar to Twitter, which is that, I mean, there are a downside and an upside at once. It's the public nature of them both acts as a promotional device for your responsiveness as a company, and it acts as an accountability risk. First of all, in the very short term, you run the risk of answering anybody's question of if you answer it in a way that's perceived as rude or not helpful or dismissive, anybody else in the world can see that. And then there's the problem that if you make sort of even a vague promise or a vague allusion to wanting to do something, people will dig it up 5 years later and remind you that you never did it. So, <Yeah. laughs> you know, this will happen on Twitter too. You'll say something like, you know, yes, I agree. That's a real unfortunate shortcoming of the app. And I really want to get that fixed someday. And then
that doesn't fit in 140 characters. What?
And then 5 years later they go, you know, often with a little tinge of snark, like, so how's that going? You know,
right.
Like, ugh.
The thing about Twitter is you're constantly working against the clock, kind of where the people are not going to find old stuff on Twitter.
That's true.
It's much more fleeting. It fades away. Whereas with forums, one of the whole points is that people should be able to find answers to old questions, right? There's a search box usually up there prominently, you know, in that way, forums and like a frequently asked questions or a knowledge base are very similar.
I think what I would prefer is something that capitalizes on the shared knowledge and, you know, the fact that people can search for an answer with some of that fleeting nature of Twitter that you described. So I think, like, if I could just snap my fingers and make this work easily, I would have my forums like auto expire after what, 6 months, whatever the shortest period of time is that nobody could embarrass me for saying that I had promised to fix something.
If you're serious at that point, why have four? I mean, at that point, you're taking away one of the useful things about forums. So it seems better just to get rid of them and just use Twitter or just use.
Well, then Facebook. And that's why I'm saying if I could just snap my fingers and make this work. But the second part of that dream scenario is that I would be actively working whenever I do answer something in a compelling way, you know, in a useful way for future reference, to make that into a more legitimate like knowledge base article or something.
I think that's important and it requires kind of conscious effort. But on my new product, I have basically, so I have the web app that has like a simple about page and various screens maybe have like a little snippets of help text, but then I have like a help site. It's help dot whatever it is. And it's actually a blog, but every post is about some topic, you know, how do I configure this? How do I set up this to work this way? And I haven't launched the product yet, but I've already written, I don't know, half a dozen, you know, blog posts / articles. And I hope to keep adding to them. And then I'm just going to point to them often. Yep. And if something's missing, I'll add it. And I found that so far, obviously the product hasn't launched, so I don't know what people really think, but so far I really like that because it's using existing tools that I know and love and kind of adapting them to work as like a knowledge base kind of archive like that.
Yeah. This is one of those examples where I've been wanting to do something like that for years, and I let the anxiety about the technicalities of how to do it stop me in my tracks. So I end up being like, oh, what if I, you know, will the permalinks ever break? Or what if I want to organize it by this or that? And what if I want to change the subdomain? I don't know. I get overly concerned about those kinds of things. But you know, to some extent, my Red Sweater blog does act as a kind of knowledge base. And a lot of my most common support responses include a link to some post on the Red Sweater blog. So I think there's something to be said for using a blog for this purpose.
I think what's missing, if I were to jump in about your blog, and your blog, I mean, it has a long history and it's great. And it also allows comments for a short time, which I think helps that community aspect. But what's missing, I think, is finding old stuff, right? So like having a way to highlight.
Yep.
So like on my new help site / blog, like on the about page, I handpick like here are the top articles like to get started. Right.
Right.
So like being able to go back in time and say, for someone that's just going to the main site, the main homepage of the blog, here are the things that you probably are interested in.
Yeah.
And but it doesn't take a lot to turn a blog into that.
No, and I mean, it could even be the kind of thing where you use categories or tags or something to identify which, you know, which blog posts, which, you know, which blog posts are just actual blog posts or, you know, non-knowledge-based blog posts, and which ones also kind of double as this reference material.
Yeah, yeah, that makes sense.
So maybe that's what I'll try to do, because I actually have been in a little bit of a rut too with all of my blogging, but with the company blog, I haven't been blogging on the company blog much except for, you know, product releases.
Yeah, I think that's a great idea, and I'm not gonna like call you out. I'm glad you mentioned that, because I do think you should blog more. I noticed when you posted about TVOS that you basically blog once a month. I'm not trying to like criticize your blog, but it's like, I mean, come on, you're a blogger, you have blog software, you should be blogging. I mean, I blog like 50 times a month. I mean, it's like with the microblog stuff, like you really should be, in my opinion, blogging a little more often.
You know? Oh, yeah. Yeah, I agree.
It's just like, oh, it's again, it's the Twitter, you know, it's like that's where all the writing gets sucked into for most people. But again.
And it's true that most of the time these days that I do blog, it's like I'm kind of like, ugh, this doesn't fit in a tweet. You know, and it's maybe something about my personality.
You need to get a good blogging habit back now before that 10,000 character thing launches.
Oh, I know.
Traps you.
No, I think I'm going to commit not to use that. That's not my style. See, that goes back to what I was saying to you last week about the 10,000 limit. I think that's for people who, for whatever reason, they don't have it in them to put this stuff elsewhere. And but I would never make that decision. I knock on wood. I don't think I would ever make the decision that putting long form writing in an attachment to a tweet is my style.
And getting back to the whole support thing and being able to link to things.
Like, yeah.
Good luck finding and linking to that later. I mean, I guess it'll probably have some kind of, you know, permalink on Twitter.com. But if your goal is to create an archive and kind of history of solved problems for Mars Edit, like, yeah, that should be on Red Sweater.
Yep, agreed.
Okay, this week we are happy to welcome a brand new sponsor to Core Intuition. It's SmartGo. Play Go, the game that both Facebook and Google are trying to solve. The game of Go has very simple rules, but really complex strategy. And unlike chess, Go has not been conquered by computers yet. The artificial intelligence teams at Facebook and Google are trying to change that. So how do you learn more about the fascinating board game? Easy. Download the Smart Go Player app to try the game. Smart Go Player includes a tutorial with over 100 problems to help you learn the rules and practice your tactics. Then, as you play against the computer and keep improving, Smart Go automatically adjusts the handicap to keep the game challenging. Go to smartgo.com/coreint to learn more.
Yeah, Manton, you know, Go is one of these games that I've been hearing about for years, and I always thought, boy, I would be a cooler, smarter person if I knew how to play Go, because everybody I've ever met who plays Go is like one of these cool smart people. And this was a cool opportunity for me to, you know, check out the app. And one of the great things about the app is it is aware of the fact that, you know, many people, I guess, don't know how to play Go yet. So it has built into it sort of tutorial mode where it walks you through from very basic, very beginner steps. And I was very grateful for that, because I was like, here is a very simple layout on the board. What would the black, you know, player do to, you know, capture the white player? And then you can try anything on the board, and it's just like, it'll tell you if you did the wrong thing. You can tap a little button to get a hint. And through this series of steps, reading both the instructions in the tutorial guide and the and getting the feedback from how it says you did in the tutorial, this interactive tutorial teaches you the basics of Go. So now, Manton, you and I could play a game of Go, I guess.
Right. Yeah, I had never played this before either. And I mistakenly thought I'd played Pende before, which for some reason I thought would be similar, but it's actually quite a bit different. But it seems similar because there's like a grid and you've got these little stones. But how you win the game is completely different. And so I got the app and I just started using it. And then I realized I don't know how to play this game, but the app does a great job of guiding you through, like you said, and then has a book for learning more about Go. And so I've really enjoyed this so far. Yeah, I can check this one off my list, learn how to play Go, and then next maybe become a little bit better at it.
Here's something cool about this app too, just from like an indie developer point of view. This is an indie app developed by a guy named Anders Kierulf. Sorry, Anders, if I'm not getting your last name exactly right there. But he's been working on this thing for full time for 15 years. And what kind of person goes into indie software development to make a Go game? A person who has a PhD in computer Go. So this guy is the right guy to make Go software, and he has really put a lot of work into making this an interactive set of software. It's, you know, there's a sort of more beginner Go game, Smart Go Player. It's just $3 in the App Store, and then you can, you know, if you're a little bit more advanced, you can get the $20 version, which I guess has harder, more challenging stuff that certainly Manton and I are not quite ready for yet. But there's a ton of stuff here. Thanks very much to Smart Go for sponsoring Core Intuition. And once again, folks, you can learn more at smartgo.com/coreint.
So Daniel, Apple recently announced iOS 9.3, and they've done this a couple times, and I find the way they announce this even more interesting than what it contains. It looks like a solid release. It's got new features, and we can certainly go on and on about those. But the way they launched it is interesting because it's not released yet, but they have this like beautiful, you know, marketing page, classic Apple webpage, highlighting all the features. And of course, they do this for major operating system releases, but like 9.3, for them to do this in the kind of mid-cycle is kind of interesting.
Yeah.
Like, get people excited about the release before it's available, and also tell them what to expect and how to use the new stuff so that when it does drop, they won't be like, what's 9.3? They'll know, oh yeah, that's the one that's going to add, you know, this night mode feature and this other stuff for schools and, you know, whatever else is in there.
Yeah. And it's, I mean, is it just me? Is it just the emphasis on the marketing from Apple, or does this actually have more feature content than a typical dot update for iOS?
It feels like more, you're right. It feels like it could almost be not an iOS 10, but it feels like a lot. Yeah. And what does that mean for iOS 10 too? Is iOS 10 going to be so big that they needed to do this release in the middle just to get some of the features out early? I don't know.
Or there's just somebody on the team who has the same kind of petty attitude problems about version numbering as you and I have. And they're like going to go now through 9.3, 9.4, 9.5 because they just don't want to get to 10.0.
Yeah, and it could be, oh, please no. But it could be like it could be stuff that they were working on for, I don't know. It's probably been in the planning for a while, but maybe it's just a collection of stuff that just wasn't ready in time for iOS 9 and also wasn't ready in time for 9.1 and 9.2
right,
because those were more focused on stability, bug fixes, you know, keeping it robust.
And do you think there's an element here, though, also that, and here's where I fall short because I don't keep up on Android and, you know, what's going on in the competitor sphere, really. But I wonder if this is somehow a tactical heading off of expected news or actual news already announced from Google.
Ooh, I don't
like
know
if this is.
I feel like so Google's conference I/O is similar to WWDC, right? It's usually a little bit before.
Yeah, it's in May this year, I think.
So that's still a ways off. I don't know. Yeah, you're right. I'm not clued in enough to really know if this has anything to do with that. And also, how often does Google ship features in the middle of a release? I'm not even sure.
I don't know. So this 9.3, you know, last year you started speculating about the possibility of Apple bringing back, what is it, 5-inch?
4-inch.
4-inch, 4-inch model. And you thought it's going to be maybe in the mid-year, like maybe in spring.
Yeah.
And I thought, no way, never. Manton's wrong again. And then, but this, 9.3, kind of, maybe that's timed to coincide with a new set of like surprise mid-year devices.
I like it. I hope it's true. It sounded like this. So there's even more rumors about the 4-inch phone. It seems like an almost certainty at this point that we're going to see a phone sometime in the next couple months, like February, March. So I'm very excited about that. I'll be buying one immediately. But I don't know how much this plays into that. Maybe they had this stuff they wanted to get out and now they can focus the next month or two on the phone and new devices. It's hard to say. It's hard to tell how they think about it internally. But it looks like a solid release, and I don't know if they've set an actual release date for it, but you know, it's right there on the homepage of Apple.com. It's like, this is what you can expect, everybody, not just developers. Like, this is what's coming.
Yeah, I don't know what to expect either. One thing that's interesting on the subject of Google, you know, they changed their location for their conference, their I/O conference, mm-hmm. from San Francisco to Mountain View, and this just has me wondering, like, well, it just put the idea in my head, like, I don't think Apple's going to move from San Francisco for WWDC, but. But wouldn't that throw everybody off if they did? It's gotten to the point now, like, we've celebrated in past years that, you know, we got things like all WWDC and the Layers conference. We got all this stuff that's like building up this ecosystem of developer conference related things. And everyone's always trying to guess the date, right? And we make these expectations, we make these predictions like, well, Apple can't have the conference that week because like the venue already shows that like the, you know, American Pharmacists Association is meeting there. And then we're all like trying to predict. And then what if they're just like, oh yeah, by the way, WWDC is, I don't know, it's in Austin this year. Woohoo!
I don't think they'll ever move away from, you know, there's some mile radius from Cupertino. They'll never move too far away from that because of the engineers needing to be there and everybody else from Apple. But I would love to see a venue change. I love Moscone West, but it's just simply not big enough. And, you know, I criticize Google a lot, not huge fan of an ad-based business, but credit to them for a couple of things. One, announcing their conference ahead of time. Thank you.
Like, yeah, right.
I mean, this isn't unreasonable to announce a conference, you know, five months ahead of time, 6 months ahead of time. So Google has done that. They've set the dates. You can book tickets. You know, for flights and hotels and plan. Of course, Apple's not going to announce WWDC until like 3 weeks before it hits.
Right.
But also credit to them for trying something kind of crazy and new with the venue, because they've picked this amphitheater, not just a location change, but like completely different feel. It's outside, really. Right. I don't know if you've seen pictures of this place, but it seats more than Moscone West in like reserve seating with actual seats. And then there's this lawn in the back because it's for concerts and stuff, right? And then you can fit another 10,000 people or however many in the back. And of course, there may be an issue with 10,000 people being out if it's raining or something like that. I don't know. But I like that they're trying something, because that's my complaint with Apple is like, I know it's hard to solve the issue of WWDC, but like try something. I don't know. Anything. Just try something. Try to change some part of it to allow more people in.
Yeah, well, I don't think Google's going to have a rain date for Google I/O, but
but isn't that a concern? I don't know. Is that like just it seems like there's a lot of backup plans that would have to happen if I don't know. It's just it's more risky, right, than if you're in a like a controlled space, like a.
Well, remember what Apple got so much credit for their use of the Bill Graham Civic Auditorium in San Francisco, the way that they apparently just sort of like built a whole temporary venue within the venue.
Right.
And whatever Google has in mind for Google I/O, a big lawn where they normally have rock concerts isn't the right venue probably for that.
Are you thinking so they'll build something?
It makes me think they must be planning to build something temporarily even.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know what, what the deal is.
You're right.
Shoreline Amphitheater used to be like a mainstream, like go-to place for concerts in the Bay Area. And I don't know if it still serves that function or if it's like been shut down or like, can Google take it over? I don't know.
I'm sure with enough money, they could take it over for a week.
Yeah.
I mean, and that, I guess that's my thinking. When I'm thinking of a place like this, I'm thinking of a band there for one night. And of course, they would never have enough money to change anything about the venue. But Apple and Google are special cases. You're right. They could come in a week ahead of time and completely. I mean, all the work they did for that. What was the event? They were announcing, was it the Apple Watch or? I don't know, whatever, but what you're talking about with that venue, it's like that was all just for like a couple hours. They did all that work. And so imagine what they could do if they know they're going to be there all week.
Yeah, they should just make like a Burning Man type event. It's in the middle of the desert and they just build. Everyone brings RVs, generators, and we all just hang out. dance around, paint our bodies, program Max.
This is a quite different feel to it than previous WWDCs. Yeah.
Oh.
It's a issue, though. I don't know if you've thought much about WWDC, but, you know, I was chatting with someone the other day, and it's like acknowledging the fact that hotels already in San Francisco, if you book them right now, 6 months out, I mean, good luck finding something that isn't like double what you were paying a couple years ago. And it's an issue.
Yeah, they tended to, well, I did this search, and they tended to be like $400 a night, which... Oh, man, I don't know. I know the march of progress, but to me, that's still like in unattainable rich person territory for me. Like, I don't know. There's like a psychological block where I don't know if I can spend $400 a night on a hotel.
It's ridiculous. So, you know, and it's not just one night, right? That's the problem. Like,
right, of course.
I've had pretty good luck the last couple of years. So the last couple of years, I haven't had a ticket. I've gone out anyway and really gotten a lot out of the kind of the conference and everything around it. But I've had a pretty short week. So I go out Sunday morning, first flight usually. So I have all Sunday to do whatever, enjoy the city, kind of get acclimated. And then I usually fly out like maybe Thursday morning or something. So that saves a couple nights at a hotel maybe. Maybe I'll cut that even shorter Wednesday, because I think you can get a lot out if you don't have a ticket just going out for a few days. But still, yeah, if you spend all week, $400 a night, it's outrageous.
Well, I mean... Yeah, that's going to add up real quick. And I don't know, maybe this is just the way things are going, that only, you know, really wealthy people or, you know, totally corporate backed individuals can actually go. I mean, for years now, it hasn't been cheap to go for many people, especially if you're coming from Europe or something like that. But those of us in the US, like if we could like muster the airfare and then plan on maybe spending up to $200 a night on a room. And so you're talking about a few thousand dollars investment usually, right? Yeah. And that's a lot of money. I don't want to diminish how much money that is, especially to, you know, certain people, depending on your circumstances. But if it starts getting up into like $5,000, $6,000, I don't know. I was complaining about this somewhere on the Slack or on Twitter or something, and somebody chimed in that they had spent, the last time they went to WWDC from Europe, they had spent $10,000.
Oh my goodness.
So I have a lot of respect for the Europeans and people from elsewhere in the world coming to the US for this event. I don't know, maybe on some level the sheer cost of accommodations in San Francisco now will actually diminish demand for the conference. I mean, the funny thing is, I would say, oh, the great thing about San Francisco is, even though it's a big, like, world-class city, that even during WWDC, they have so much hotel capacity that you could still get, you know, pretty reasonable hotels for $150, $200 a night. And that just seems like that's out the window now. That's gone.
I still feel like WWDC is an important event as to have like one place for people to go and meet up. You know, we have a lot of great regional conferences. We mentioned CocoComp on this show, and there's others. And it's like those are important, but not everyone goes to those, right? That not everyone descends on Austin, Texas, for example. It'd be great, but this doesn't happen for our community. And so WWDC is that one place everyone should at least try to go to, and anything that discourages people from going or makes it, you know, just unfeasible financially is disappointing. Like, what would you pay if you were Apple right now and you were planning for WWDC? Like, what would you do about the venue? Like, I mean, you've lived in the area. I mean, I've visited, you know, 20 times, but it's not the same as actually living there. Like, is there a place that's a little more outside of the city that it could fit people and that would be more reasonably priced for attendees, but also something that's convenient for Apple so they can, you know, bus people in from Cupertino or wherever?
I don't know of a place. Obviously, I wasn't tuned into that, but I think that is the challenge. I don't think the Bay Area is set up for that.
Yeah. I mean, it's almost, you get me thinking about the retrofitting of building. Like, I almost feel like they should pick a nice neighborhood with some good hotels that's outside the city that also has like a warehouse or something, you know, something yeah. that's like they can just take over. And I mean, look at yeah. what they're doing with their new campus. Like right. the resources they have, if they want to literally, you know, not build something from scratch, but, you know, kind of remodel and, you know, make a space that would be amazing for developers. Like they could do that if they want to.
Yeah. And maybe it will be, maybe that will be where their conferences are in the future. I don't know. Like, I don't think they're really building in a lot of space for that capacity, but you never know. And if they are building stuff inside buildings, I mean, one of the reasons that it's always been said that they don't use the main Moscone spaces, you know, they use Moscone West, which is kind of this little add-on to Moscone Center, which is where the giant like Macworld style exhibition floor type stuff usually happens. And people have said, well, they can't expand into those buildings because they're just like kind of big open spaces. But like we've been saying, if they're in the mood and have the budget to just like build up things temporarily, maybe they can just get in there and make that into a ginormous, you know, city of classrooms.
Yeah, but, doesn't solve the housing problem, but I agree. I don't see any reason why they couldn't expand into that. They have successfully, you know, have run trade shows there many, many, many times. It's a solvable problem.
Yeah.
All right, Daniel, it's good talking to you this week. We're going to wrap the show up, but thanks everyone for listening to the podcast this week. If you have any feedback, you can send it to us on Twitter at Corint or via email at feedback@corint.org. Goes to both of us.
Yeah, it was great talking to you again, as always, Manton, and I look forward to catching up with you again next week.
All right, bye.